Hello, is this Jerry Seinfeld?
Yeah. What are you doing? You want to get some coffee?
No. Sorry, I also have here on the line, I should be more specific. I merged two calls. So I have Jerry Seinfeld and a very special guest, Jerry Seinfeld.
Let's get coffee!
No, there no coffee today, guys. I just want to talk to you about B-movie.
A B-movie? Why not an A-movie?
Well, that's a good one, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry!
Do you guys think you'll do another B movie or you got it already?
Sure! If the price is right, I'll do it!
That's a good point. You know, I think I agree with Jerry on this one.
Okay, great. So you're both do you both like B movie? Do you rewatch it? Do you recommend it to friends? Should people watch it?
I love every movie I've been in.
Okay, Well, thank you. So I'm a huge fan of both of you, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the program. I mean, it's really exciting.
What program is this?
It's Bad Science.
We should get coffee.
Yeah, I'd love to get coffee with you. That would be great. That's a dream of mine.
Where are you? I'm right around the corner.
I'm in Culver City. What are you driving?
Oh, it's a 1975 Camaro.
That was the first year that they went convertible.
I know, Jerry, I know.
What a great car.
Bad Science. Did the movie get it right? Bad Science. Or will we have to fight? Bad Science.
Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Bad Science. I'm Ethan Edinburgh, and today I am through the roof excited to be talking about B-movie from 2007, I think.
2007.
Yeah. Jerry Seinfeld's B-movie. I can't say critically acclaimed. I think mediocrely acclaimed film.
If there was any acclaim, that would be a surprise to me. Be surprised to hear there was a claim for B-movie.
With a stern view on B-movie, you're hearing his voice right now. He is a writer, actor, improviser you may know from the series Drive Share or his unbelievable improv group Convoy or his own talk show called Science Time with Alex Berg. It's Alex Berg.
Hello.
How's it going, Alex?
I'm good.
Great. I'm glad that you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It took us way too long to get you in this room.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a long commute, so.
That's a barrier. Talking to us is a professor. This intro, by the way, is going to take a while because I have many questions about your past, not to put pressure on you, but professor of entomology at the University of California, Boris Baer.
Hello. How's nice to be here.
Oh, fantastic. You brought your whole family here today.
Yes. Yep.
So nice. Yep. They're not in the room right now. So they would be applauding and cheering, I'm sure. But
probably they're all into bees.
They're all into bees?
Yes.
Good. Oh, wow.
Good
so
family.
You also do work with CYBR. Am I saying that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Center for Integrative Bee Research, as of course Alex and I and everybody else knows.
Yes.
And so can you first tell me about that?
So what you probably all know, and that is pretty widespread knowledge by now, is that the bees are in trouble.
Yes.
And we are very dependent on bees. I'm pretty sure we're talking about that quite a while, or for quite a while in the future. So research has responded to that. And by now, I think like we have realized it's not just the honeybees, it's the bees in general, even the insects in general, where we see like massive declines and losses. And that has very kind of severe consequences for human mankind. So I think that, you know, we kind of took an approach that is very bee-like. So, you know, you bring together bee brains, you make like a larger
hive
colony, you know, yeah. you bring in the super colony kind of effect. So we kind of packed up kind of a number of scientists at the University of Riverside. At the moment, it's 9 professors that are sitting there and all their kind of offspring, all these kind of worker bees that they have around, right? And we formed that Center for Integrative Bee Research, which the general idea is like to look into what are the problems, how can we find new solutions, how can we implement these solutions with beekeepers, but also with the growers. So that's the general idea.
Okay, I have so many questions on it, but before I jump into that pool, bee movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, man. Way to bring the mood down.
Before we get into that exciting event, what'd you think of bee movie? When did you first see bee movie? What was your opinion on that?
So I was really excited when I heard about it in 2007, because for me as a scientist, this problematic of declining bees and losing bees is much older than probably what the public is aware of by now. That for me, that started at the beginning of my PhD, which I did in Switzerland, I think 1997 or something like that. Among the beekeepers, among the researchers, there was always like this fear, like, what's happening? Where are the bees? Why do we don't find kind of bumblebees in Switzerland anymore? And then, like, you know, we were working on that for a while. I wanted to save the bees, but it was like, it was not out there, right? It was something that was restricted to, as I said, to researchers, conservation people, certainly the beekeepers, they complained that they lost bees. So 2007, you know, I was in Australia. We were running a bee health center there at that point. And I thought, wow, finally somebody really kind of got it up, right, and brings it on the table. And I realized that I went to the movie theater together with some beekeeper friends, I think, and certainly with my family. And I think it was the only time where I was close to be thrown out of the movie theater. Oh. Right? Because I went through the roof of what I saw there.
You seem like a pretty calm guy.
Yeah, but that was too much. I mean, some of the things were simply too much.
The Swiss are not now known for their outbursts.
No,
you know,
we're normally pretty neutral. Right, so it takes you some time to really get up, but there were some things that I couldn't kind of really get down. It was like, so yeah.
I would much rather watch video footage of you watching B movie than B movie.
Well, we took two revenges on that, right? The first thing was, like I said, well, you know, I'm teaching bees and beekeeping. I have students. I will use the B movie doing my teaching to basically have to tell or kind of introduce the students to like what's all wrong, like in the public opinion about bees. Because believe it or not, you know, we're doing a lot of outreach. So we're going to schools, we have an insect fair in Riverside. We had several big exhibitions in Australia about bees. And like you're having your little kind of table there and your live beehive and people come in. And what you hear is like, you're telling them what they see, you know, what you can see inside the hive, the different kind of bees and what they do. And the typical response is, yeah, but in the bee movie, right? Yeah, but in the bee movie. And I can't hear that sentence anymore. You know, it's like just coming up that experience from 2007.
That's a tough movie to cite for anything.
Yeah, like,
even outside the realm of bees, just cite as like, well, the bee movie did it this way. It's like, well, then that's a great argument not to listen to it.
Yeah. You're clearly a schmuck. Like, why would you say that?
Yeah. Can you see the six legs? Yeah, but in the bee movie, they only have four legs, right? So like, right. No, they have six legs.
Yeah.
And some people kind of try to insist and say, no, you should do your research, right? And
you should do your research.
Yes, yeah. You're standing there as
to
a
be fair, you should do your research. Bees only have four legs.
Yeah.
They also have normal human eyes and teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And males sting, right? It's like male bees don't sting. In any social insect, males don't sting. They also don't work, right? It's like it's the very basics that they got wrong.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask about. We're hopping to the knowledge here, but I love it. Male bees, I read, just mate. What else do they do? I don't understand.
They are only produced really during the reproductive event. So when a colony wants to reproduce, they're pretty useless. It's like the interesting thing about bee societies or ant societies or wasp societies, they're all kind of together in this social insect kind of group. And they're all female driven. It's like the females run the show. So the males are only produced during very short periods of time. They don't work.
What do they spend their time doing?
They plan to get out to find a queen and mate with them. And that's basically it. If they don't succeed with that, and the chances that they actually succeed is really low, right? You have a virgin queen flying out and you have about, I don't know, 10 to 15,000 males that chase her, and she's never going to mate with all of them. So most of the males are basically just a waste of time and energy for the, for the colony.
Yeah. Yeah, these are calories we could have fed to a worker or something.
Yes, exactly, right? And if they return and they were not successful, they basically get killed by the workers, and they're thrown out because they just consume unnecessary energy. So
it is wild to me. Because from what I understand, there is so much work to be done if you're a bee. It takes so much to produce so little. So the fact that half of the species is just not doing anything or wasting their time, I don't...
Well, in a typical hive, you would not have any males. Right? In a bee movie, we have like the situation, it's mainly driven
by
males. Yeah.
They're all males.
It's complete nonsense.
The pollen jocks are all males.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't understand why that was done, because you could have done it with females. And
of course.
It's perfectly fine, right?
Yes, yeah.
Would have been way better, would have been accurate.
Yeah. And then it would have been accurate with the pollination, it would have been accurate with the stinger. My males don't have a stinger, and I know that I collected thousands of males and never got stung. So it's like, it's a fact, sorry.
Yeah.
How many times have you been stung?
Oh, you get stung quite often. Because I'm also kind of doing research in the lab, you know, I'm maybe not kind of on the hive on a daily basis. I think my beekeeper that I had in Australia, she needed these things like a junkie just to get up and running. I have a coffee. She got three or four stings. I think she got used to that.
Wait, were you talking dozens of stings or of hundreds of stings? How many times have you experienced this?
It depends. Like if you have like things going really wrong, like I got some birthday presents from my wife, which was a new kind of new gloves that you, if you lift the colonies really up and you carry them around,
they're going to sting.
You take gloves, right? Normally, no. On a daily basis, if I open a hive and I take a frame, I would not have any gloves. And you can, the bees are not after you. They're not kind of out there to kill you or sting you.
I watched Chef's Table last night. And there was a guy in Italy, I think, who was just like collecting honey from these panels without anything, armor, no.
Yeah.
So that's a normal.
That's in Australia, that's the way we would do it. Right?
Wow.
We're kind of relaxed. In California, a bit different because we have the Africanized bee, which is a hybrid that escaped from a lab in Brazil a couple of years ago.
Escaped from a lab in Brazil?
It was the infamous killer bee epidemic, right?
It's called the killer bee. I don't like the name that much.
Because they're not actually, to my knowledge, they're not mass murderers.
Why are they called that?
Because they have temperament. So it's a hybrid, and they deliberately kind of cross two different bee species to see like whether they will get a better bee that survives.
Oh, like in a lab, or this happened in nature somehow?
That happened in a lab, and the problem with that, the bee escaped, and then it started to kind of spread out of Brazil, and now it's kind of Southern California.
Sounds like a bad hero movie, like a superhero sci-fi film that they make.
It is
beer.
Like the first act of a low grade horror film. Like that's
right.
The plot.
And then this killer bee goes and, I don't know, attacks people, grows to an abnormal size.
No, it's like, it's a normal bee. You wouldn't kind of see any difference. It's the thing is that, like, it's just like, we call it more defensive. So, you know, but it has character, right? So it's like, if a parasite comes along with the bees that we keep among ourselves, which are managed bees or bred bees, they don't know what hits them and they are immediately wiped out. Oh. And I'm working with Africanized bees in Panama now for a while. And, you know, they're healthy bees. They're perfect, right? It's like, they just let you know that you're not really welcome.
Right.
It's like,
right, sure.
You have to take these bees more as wolves, you know, that it's a wild animal, and you have to treat it as such. Whereas like a lot of people are used to the managed bees that we keep around in our backyards, or you see them, and it's like little chihuahuas, right? Of course, they are really nice to kind of pet around and you don't need any protection. But if there is any cold night or if any disease comes along, your chihuahua is gone. Right. It's like that's the reality of things. So I'm kind of a fan of Africanized bees. I know it's like that's probably suicidal to say that because everyone else hates them. But we have these bees around. There was one reason to actually move to California, because in the southern part of California, these bees are around. You can see them in the trees. Mm. I can climb up there. And no one treats these bees, right? No one helps these bees, but they survive. They actually thrive here in Southern California.
Wow.
So are they not, are the Africanized bees not as susceptible to colony collapse as the rest of the species, or just they're handling it slightly better?
They are absolutely better at handling it. You know that, right? It's what we don't know is like how they do it. Mm-hmm. So I climb up there, I get them down, and give me some answers.
What do you mean get them down?
You're going to talk.
Yell at bees a lot.
Well, what we do is like we compare, so we expose bees to stressors that we know that like play a role. We know that parasites are a big kind of reason why bees decline. We know that pesticide exposure, bad beekeeping, environmental change, the loss of environmental kind of landscapes that are bee friendly, we lose all that. Yet the Africanized bee actually handles that. So what we can do is we can bring these bees down. We kind of you know, we pack them away so no one is around. And we start to expose them to different stressors. And we say, so what are you doing now? Here's a parasite. Oh, you're still happy. Here's a second one. Or here's a pesticide. And then we use like scientific methods. There can be what we call molecular techniques. So we basically look into the bee blood and we see like, so what's the immune system? How's the response of the immune system? What kind of individual molecules is the bee producing? And I call these molecules my little James Bond. So it's like, it's like the killer molecules that go in there. And It was the first time that I saw the bee immune system actually fighting against the disease. And we can do that now on the bench in the lab. And I thought that's quite exciting, right? Because we had that very famous quote, apparently from Einstein, that like if the bee disappears from the globe, that human mankind would not have what, 7 years to live. It's probably wrong, but very likely wrong. But that was like the threat is like, do we lose all the bees? And I think like when, you know, you climb into a tree in Panama and you're there and, you know, you keep your distance and you keep them, you keep respect, right? You respect each other. I respect them, they respect me. But these bees are not going to disappear. There's no question, right? Mm. So I think there's hope in these bees.
And I think we do know from the most accurate movie about bees, the bee movie, that if the bees stop pollinating the flowers, which is most of the third act of the movie is the fallout of that, whether it's because of a legal lawsuit, they have such an influx of human honey, they don't need to make their own anymore, then there would be widespread chaos. And so I think what Boris is trying to say in so many words is the bee movie is his favorite movie and it's very accurate and everyone should go watch it.
Yeah,
right?
Like, that's an accurate summary.
It's really good that there's a microphone before me because at this point when people bring that up, that's when my head hits the table. And not only
you got a safety, you can catch
because,
you.
I mean, even if you're not a biologist, think about it. So they fly to Pasadena, they take some pollen from roses, and then they pollinate some stuff in Central Park.
Yeah, New York.
They just, and it's just from different flowers. Like I forced my girlfriend to watch this movie with me because misery loves company. Sure. And it was incredible because she's a writer, so she was watching the movie and reacting to all of the many transgressions it makes as a piece of writing, acting, cinema, you know. And I was watching it for this, making note of all the transgressions. And the pollen thing was one both of us were like, oh, this is lazy writing and it's inaccurate science.
Yes. Like,
we were able to come together as a Venn diagram overlap and hit both of us at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. I was telling you earlier, I don't love like trashing the movies that we do on the show, but it was hard to avoid
it's tough.
Moments this movie stepped in crap.
It's also like other people who do the show get to watch Blade Runner.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. Like, I messed up.
We had to watch B-movie?
My problem with the B-movie, and that's why I got that angry, was that like it depicts the animal from a completely wrong perspective. And people cannot distinguish between the real science facts. And the movie clearly plays around with this, right? He plays around with relatedness, with division of labor, which is all in there, right?
Yeah.
But then I think like the non-biologist or somebody, a child that watches that, or somebody who is not so familiar with bees, is not able to distinguish what is fact and what is fiction. And
totally.
That's a huge problem.
Because there's just enough, like, you know, like, oh, it's a cousin, it's a distant cousin. You know, like, there's just enough, like, factual things in the movie that, like you said, if you didn't know what was going on or you showed it, like, you know, I have a six-year-old daughter. If she watched it, those wrong facts would just get lodged in her head.
Yeah.
And it's harder to learn. It's harder to unlearn a bad fact than it is to just not know something and learn it right the first time.
True.
This movie misses a huge opportunity to be like, well, it misses an opportunity to be funny, but it also misses an opportunity to be like, hey, you can learn something about, like in the way Jurassic Park, all of us went like, oh, the dinosaurs flock, they're bird-like. You know, it's like, B-movie could have been doing that every scene in it.
Yes.
Veered wildly away from
to,
it.
To be like some sort of optimistic devil's advocate here,
yeah,
although
sure.
Of course I agree with you 1,000%. Did it also maybe inspire kids to learn about bees in general? Like just bring it up as a topic that made them like, oh, this is kind of cool. I'll do some research of my own.
I don't know. I hope so, but man, I don't know.
I mean, I wish it was more accurate. When I started, especially doing the minimal amount of research that I read, I was very surprised with how, I don't know, much they didn't care.
Or don't call it the bee movie.
Terrible name, by the
way,
right?
Come up with a different title for it. Call it like, you know, like Barry Saves the Day or something.
Yeah.
And then the focus isn't on bees. It's on Barry. And it's like, in
true.
The same way I don't watch Toy Story for accurate knowledge about the inner neural mechanisms and relationship dynamics of toys, you know,
right,
like,
right.
Then I won't watch it for that. You know, like, you know, no one watches Toy Story going like, I didn't know that cowboy toys have trust issues and they feel abandonment. And, you know, like,
right.
Don't call it B movie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Bad name in general. I thought just lazy
it's
feeling.
Tough, just
B movie.
What I didn't understand is it would have been so easy. It would not have, you could have told the exact same story,
yes. Yeah.
Right? But you could have gotten the B facts right.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. By the way, what is that story? Can you guys just quickly give me like a log line a synopsis of this film? Because to me, it had like 5-6 different stories shoved into one.
So yeah, here's my analysis. So, and I'm going to walk you through my experiences as the viewer trying to figure out what the story of this movie is from the beginning. Okay.
Great.
So the sort of the first thing that happens, you know, to me as a writer and as someone who's interested in telling stories that I go like, this is the story. The first thing that I said, this is the story, is when Jerry Seinfeld's character, Barry, decides, even though he's supposed to work till death, that's not enough for him. Okay, great. This is a story about like, what is the meaning of life? And like, you know, what does it matter if you're just working and like that sort of thing? Okay, great. But then he decides, no, it's just, I don't want that job. I want to be a pollen jock. So it's like, okay, so it's about being told what to do and like, you know, rebelling against that. Great. Then he's a pollen jock and he's like, nope, he gets lost out in the city. Okay, great. This is someone who went beyond what they're capable of doing and now they're facing repercussions for not like sort of towing the line. Great. Nope, that's not the story. It's the story of him falling in love with a human florist? Weird. Okay, no, don't worry. That's not the story. It's the story of him finding out how exploited bees are? Okay, that's kind of the story, but now it's the story of all of the bees suing humankind. Okay, great. This is clearly the story. This is the big global conflict. We have John Goodman playing a Southern lawyer. Like, they win the case. That's the story. No, that's not the story. The story is now that the world needs bees and humans to work together. Otherwise, all the flowers are dying. And then they fly a plane back from the Rose Bowl. Like, that's kind of... each one of those things could be a story.
A whole movie kind of on its own.
But, like, all in the same way that, like, you can't make a human just by like having a loose assemblage of body parts you found in a ditch somewhere. You cannot make a movie just having a loose assemblage of plot elements just crammed together. Yeah,
yeah.
Under the aegis of, and we like bees. You know, like it just doesn't.
And did the, at the end, is he dating her now? It seems like.
No, they like have a, they have like a florist / legal business. And then when he's tired of the legal business, she sends him out to pollinate flowers and he goes with the flower jocks. Like,
okay, but it did it
that
not...
part is scientifically accurate. That's how lawyers and florists do interact.
Yeah, that part is true. Thank
yeah,
God.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
yeah.
For the most part, it seemed to me like they're in a relationship now. Because there was no, it's not like she met a boyfriend or something.
There is like a weird subplot where like her and her husband are on the rocks largely because she really likes this
bee. She's having like an affair with this bee.
Yeah, and it's an emotional affair, you know,
yeah.
Like, but like he's jealous of the bee and Barry seems kind of like unaware of it, but.
Tries to kill him one point.
Yeah. He does try to like flush him down the toilet and all that stuff.
Yep.
Like it's just a, yeah, it's
which
a.
Which he surfs. He yeah, gets he, out he of via surfing.
Forgot. Yeah, he surfs on like a Q-tip or something.
It'd probably be a fun movie to watch if there's like a game to it or you know what you're getting into a little bit. But I saw it by myself here in this office thinking like, oh, I for some reason, I think I like this movie. I think I saw it in 2007 and I thought it was fun in theaters. And just, yeah, about 15, 20 minutes in was
and
so
lost.
I love
Jerry Seinfeld. I love Seinfeld.
Yeah,
like
same.
I grew up on Seinfeld. I was rooting for this movie.
Yep.
To transcend.
Love Matthew Broderick,
anything.
Too.
Yes.
John Goodman.
Renee Zellweger.
Come
like,
on.
Good A-level cast. Oh, and also the least of the film's transgressions. But the big, like, sort of climactic scene at the end when they repollinate everything
yeah.
is one of the worst covers of any Beatles song I've ever heard with
oh,
Here
man.
Comes the Sun.
Here Comes the Sun. Good call.
Being done in, like, this, yep. like, Demi Lovato, let's get, like, the six-year-olds excited sort of a
and
way
it felt
for
like,
it.
Kind of like a demo version of that.
Yes.
Right? It
yes.
didn't feel fully produced, that song.
It was a weird karaoke track take on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So strange.
Yeah. So yeah, anyway, that's my, I'll try not to gripe on B-movie too much more, but.
I just wanted to make sure we covered our bases
yes,
here.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
we're
yeah,
talking
yeah,
about this
yes.
film, and it is special in certain ways. Okay, so yeah, I have a bunch of B questions. I have questions about your, like, grants you got. You basically lived, like, everywhere on the planet, is that correct?
Yeah. Yes. Yep. But
can you name off some of these places you've been? Like, where have you spent the most amount of time? Because I was going through
yep.
your history yep. here, and yep. it just seemed endless.
So, as you can probably hear from my accent, it's not American.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought it was Southern.
I thought you were tired.
Yeah. No, I grew up in Switzerland. I was born in Switzerland. I grew up in Switzerland. I did my PhD there, and I was together with my wife on bumblebees and bumblebee health. And after that, I did do a little detour. I went to Denmark in Northern Europe, to Copenhagen, University of Copenhagen. I worked there for 2 years. And then we had this unique opportunity to spend initially 2 years in Australia at the University of Western Australia. And that was really exciting for us because at that point, and that's still true to this point, Western Australia has the healthiest bees in the world.
Healthiest bees in the world in Australia.
The point is that Western Australia is so isolated from the rest of the world that hardly anything arrived there, and you were not allowed to bring in bees. You're not kind of allowed to kind of do anything to the bees there. So all these kind of problems that we have specifically here in California, but also in China and other parts of the world, they haven't really arrived in Western Australia. So there you have a group, or we call it a population of bees, and they are super healthy. And that was just a very exciting opportunity to study them, right? So what would we actually need? What would we aim for in the future, right? So we went for 2 years to Australia to study the healthy bees. And out of the 2 years, became 15 years because we got money and we got like the interest from the beekeepers and so on, right? So that was prolonged then for that.
Yeah, I think some of the money you got was in safeguarding honeybees, increasing parasite treatment effectiveness using nanotechnology.
Yes, that was
really
one of the ideas. The point is that like, if you look at like the bee as like an animal that we keep among ourselves, it's like there's very little we can do to help it, right? So let's say you have a dog, or you have a horse, or you have a pig. If your animal gets sick, you're going to the vet, and the vet fixes it up. And we have like hundreds of medications. We can operate these animals. We are very sophisticated, right? In how we can treat these animals. Like bees, completely nothing. Right? We are very, very bad at like understanding why a bee is not healthy and doing anything against it. So what we thought is like, if you really want to make a difference, we have to have a veterinarian science. We need to kind of have bee medical treatments. And we started to kind of isolate certain kind of James Bonds, these little kind of agents that the bee produces, and we can give that to the bee, and we see that it is effective.
But how do you administer that to a bee? Like, do you put it in like a sugar solution and the bees drink it, or like, is it an injection thing? Or?
In this case, we feed the bees with specific molecules with these James Bonds, and we see that it has an effect. Yeah. But there are like new ways, and that's coming out of the medical sciences, or from human kind of medical treatments, where you can fine grind these kind of substances, so it's easier taken up by the bee. Because if you, for example, if you treat a disease, you might have heard about that we have these problems that if you take antibiotics for too long, your body basically selects for more nasty bugs. So you give a bee a medication, and you select out, or you force the parasite to become more resistant, right? And that you don't want to have that. Mm-hmm. Right? You want to protect the bee, not to breed like more kind of damaging diseases. So the way out of that is to kind of, you know, to have like to nuke the inside of the bee with a treatment that basically just takes the parasites out almost immediately, right? So we're looking for like, is there a way that we can kind of administer kind of these James Bonds in a way that we just get a clean bee out of that, right? So that is the idea. And the idea behind is say like, we want to have like new treatments that we don't have at the moment to safeguard the bee and to provide beekeepers with new solutions to manage the problems that the bee
has. And so these are treatments both for individual bees, but also colonies as a whole, or like, so like when you're treating a bee, I guess my question is, because they are such social insects, you know, and I'm inclined to believe E.O. Wilson's superorganism theory that you can treat the whole colony as one organism. So when you're talking about like, you know, flushing the parasites out, are you talking about specifically like, hey, bee number 147 has worms, we're going to get rid of these worms, as well as, hey, this colony has an infestation of some fungus, like it's both at the same time?
we are kind of really on the line with Wilson on that, on the superorganism. So we don't see the individual bee as like an entity. If I talk about honeybees, I talk about the colony as a whole, right? So what we have with bees is then like, if you look at the individual, the individual organs, individual components inside, like in our body, with a heart, with a lung, and so on. The bee is basically the same, just like we can basically open it up. If you lift the lid of the colony, you can basically, you can do open brain surgery. Right? You can look at that. So if you need to save the bees, or if you need to have to protect the bees, we have to do that on the colony level, not on the individual level. Although, of course, like the individual will take it up and will kind of, if it's a gut parasite, it will clear that out of the gut of the bee. But is the really interesting thing about kind of honeybees is they have two levels of what we call immunity, so how they can defend themselves. One is the one that I just talked about, right? It's like the bee produces a molecule, a James Bond, as part of the immune system, and then clears that disease. But they also have a second kind of level of immunity that we call social immunity. Right? So these are behaviors, and they communicate with each other about this. So, for example, a beehive can produce fever. So if the colony gets infected, they communicate with each other, oh, we got something into the colony, and they rise the colony to cook the disease to death, right? If a hornet comes into the colony and tries to kind of destroy the colony or attack the brood, they form a ball around that hornet, and they all turn on their flight muscles, and they cook the hornet in the middle to death. This is social immunity, right?
Which bees do this?
These honeybees do honeybees that. Do Asian this. Honeybees do that. Yes, and even kind of if the larvae get infected, they can recognize that they got an infection, and they can release a pheromone, a molecule, and the bees around the nurse bees pick that up and take that larvae out and kick it out. We call that hygienic behavior. Right? So it's like we have a lot of opportunities to basically kind of find bees, breed bees, help bees to basically deal with the problems that are around, certainly when it comes down to parasites. And there's like, I don't think we take really enough advantage of that, because if you look at like beekeeping or bee breeding at the moment, it's all towards one point, and that's we need more honey and we need more bees and we want to get less dung, right? And we have to kind of rethink that to a certain degree. But there are these opportunities, and bees can, as I said, like they have several levels of how they can deal with problems.
So you're saying we need like insect vets, like offices where people go out and help these animals?
That was another frustrating part in my life, because like I went to the vet departments and said like, look, I can come in. I can provide you with lectures, right? I can tell them what I know, because I think like for the vets, there could be some side income. But I think, I don't know, the vets, you know, if it doesn't have a vertebrate, it's like, It's like, And then they have to drive out, because a beekeeper cannot bring 600 hives in to the vet.
You can't sit in a waiting room with a whole apiary going like, I don't know.
Probably not. I don't know whether it's a good idea.
It just seems kind of down lately. I don't know what's going on with it.
So we decided, okay, if the vet's not doing it, we have to kind of, we basically have to replace him. And one of the ideas to replace him is to basically have a little device that we put into the hive. It's an electronic sensor, or it's not one sensor, it's actually multiple sensors. And these sensors, they basically listen into the language of the bee, because the bee language is basically, it's not sound-based, it's based on pheromones. So the bees spread that around. If a bee gets sick, there's a molecule that appears, right? If the queen is lost, we know that what kind of molecules appear there. So if you have the right sensors, we can actually listen into the language of the bee. And if the sensor picks something up, he can send you a warning on your mobile phone, your colony has just lost the queen or you, right? So at the moment, we try to crack into the bee language to understand what are the key molecules and when do we hear like when the bees talk to us. And instead of a vet, we can do that with an app on the mobile phone. So that is some of the ideas how we want to tackle that.
And so within like being able to understand like the bee, like pheromone communication well enough and bees to listen in, is there also like a complementary program to go like, okay, well, we know when bees release this pheromone, it triggers this kind of behavior in the hive. Are you guys also looking into like, well, we're going to like inject like synthetic pheromones into the beehive to induce the behavior we want? Is that part of this veterinary treatment as well?
Not so much at the moment. I think I wouldn't say we are at the end of this. We're in the middle of the road.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And that's why some of the reasons why we stress, for example, Africanized bees, right? So we give them some stress factors, and then we want to know how do we react. And some of the way we measure that reaction is like, so what do you? How do you smell today? You know, it's like armpits, right? Like yeah. We open the hive.
Yeah.
Of course.
I'm a human. I'm a normal human who greets people by smelling their armpits. I understand. You don't need to explain it to me.
Yeah, we had a really long introduction earlier.
Yeah.
But that's the general idea is I don't think we have enough kind of put enough kind of efforts into understanding the bee language. And they talk to us. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you realize that when you keep bees, it's like, yeah, you have a dog, you have a cat, that's easy, right? Bees are very complicated.
Wow.
Different hives have different characters. They have good days, they have bad days. Yeah, you open a hive and...
How can you tell if they're having a good day or a bad day?
You listen to them, Ethan.
I'm sorry. What
you ask
saying?
How they're doing and you listen.
I just have so many thoughts.
Yeah, you actually do. So one kind of way is you listen to the sound. So they have zipping sounds and they like you see how many bees are in the air, how much noise is in the air. You interact with that animal.
Okay.
And I don't have scientific data for that, but in Australia, we had a beekeeper. She was a fourth generation beekeeper. And she basically grew up with bees. And when she opens a hive, the bees are just calmer.
Whoa.
And she opens a hive and within seconds, she can tell you, yeah, the queen is here or she's not around. The queen or the hive is sick.
So she can read the pheromones.
She smells it. You can hear it. Some diseases you can smell. Others you can hear. You can also look at the behavior of individual bees. So are they calm? You know, you open the hive, the bees just do their thing. Mm. Do they start to get their butts in the air? Because then they spread pheromones right to the others. So they can get their butts up and then they turn on the wings, the flight muscles, and that spreads the pheromone around. So you can see this and you learn... As you go, I'm looking at bees now for about 20, 30 years, and I don't think I understand them completely at all, right? Mm. But I think some of the things we understand, and it gives us big hope, you know, if we use modern technology, that all these things that we can't smell and hear, that a sensor could actually smell that and hear that for us and tell us what the bees have told us.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. I hope you had a snack. Here we go back to the show about science.
In preparation for today's podcast, I read a book that's been sitting on my shelf for a couple months that I've been like putting off, but this like gave me like the impetus I needed to crack it open. And it was Carl von Frisch's lectures on bees that Donald Griffin then, you know, did their introduction to in the 70s or whatever. And I was so fascinated reading through like just the comparatively simple experiments that he had done in the early part of the 20th century to figure out like, okay, well, here's how the waggle dance works. So when a bee does this, we know that they're aligning themselves with the sun and they do that via polarization. And when they dance this way, it means go towards the sun. And when they dance that way, it means go away from the sun. And it's, you know, I studied a lot of cog sci in college and there was a lot of comparative psychology that came along with that. And like bees strike me and Boris, I feel like I'm about to say something that could be like deeply offensive, but I truly don't mean it that way. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Bees strike me as a kind of like organic robot that was built and do have like a bunch of like very purpose-built like rules and behaviors that they follow. And for trying to treat something as vast and important as colony collapse disorder, for me, that's like a bit optimistic that it's like, well, yeah, no, there's rules they follow. None of them can tell us the rules directly in English, but like, if you pay close attention, there is a way to figure out what's going on there, and we can hopefully try to, you know, turn the boat around, so to speak.
I offended Boris. Hell yeah, got him.
I've been waiting this whole time. I've been looking for some way to do
there
it.
There we go again.
Yeah, but I'm very curious. I'm not a bee expert. Yeah, I'm a dude, you know, but I'm curious to hear your perspective.
Come to the bee yard and work there for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Open the hives every day and you can see the difference. They are remarkably flexible. And again, like the Bee movie, completely got it wrong, right? In that, like, the guy in the beginning says, I have to choose a job for my life, right? And then they work me to death. The honeybee is the prime example of division of labor. So they have different jobs, 20, 30 different jobs, but they actually reallocate them. So as bees become older, it's a natural kind of... you switch the job. Even if you split the hive into two hives, they actually reallocate jobs. Wow. So you have like a progression of different jobs. So when they are born, they're nurse bees, and then they start to build comb, and then they look after the young, they look after queen, they go out. But if there is a need, they actually... they can come in and they recruit bees so they can become foragers and afterwards they become builders. So depending on what it is required in the hive, jobs get moved around. So there is some flexibility in that system, which is non-robot. And I think like, so that's the scientific kind of view at least. If you work with bees, you will almost certainly realize that they are not robots. They respond. They respond to the environment. They respond to you. And they respond over time. So a hive that you open in spring has a very different character compared to a hive that you would open in autumn, or a hive that has lost the queen, or where the queen is present, or when they are producing males or not producing males. So there is something more to these bees than just being little robots.
Right, they're not total automatons.
There is... And that's not,
yeah, I mean, it's a spectrum, obviously. We're not going to settle it here, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm inclined to believe anything Boris says over me. For anybody who's listening, please.
It's actually dangerous for me as a scientist to say that, right? Because, like, you know, how much personality has a beehive? How much personality? It's normally something we wouldn't like to touch necessarily. Right? For us, it's like, yeah, it's a bee. Here are the genes. Here's what they produce. That's it, right? They're doing the thing. What you said, they're robots. Yet when you work with bees and work with honeybees, but also worked with bumblebees, you realize, oh, there's a bit more than that.
You fall in love with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one thing, absolutely. And that's really dangerous because it can really kind of mess up your life.
Yeah. They sting.
They sting, and then you lose your husband because he only cares about tennis or ping pong or something.
Yeah. Right. He's David Putty. And
you need to marry a beekeeper woman, right? And then you're all fine.
Yeah, then you're fine.
That's what I did.
Like, I get it, yeah. I'm just backing up 1 second. So you're saying that the bees change jobs, and I know that there are some physiological differences between, like, workers and drones and, you know, like, within a beehive. When, if you were to say, like, split a hive in two and the bees were to switch jobs, or you were to combine hives, or one of these events that triggers bees to switch jobs, do the bees undergo physiological changes as well? Like, do they do they beef up or something like that? Or
they
really
have physiological changes? Yes.
Yeah.
For example, like,
it's incredible.
Yeah, they have specific glands that they use to produce royal jelly, to feed the larvae, to feed the queen. So these glands can grow, but they can also shrink back again.
Yeah.
The queen can go through cycles where, like, the ovaries kind of grow in size and shrink back depending on whether she has to lay a lot of eggs or not so many eggs. The bee is not growing or shrinking.
No, but internally there are.
Massive changes that are associated with that. And as I said, that's flexible. And that makes, I think, the entire system so remarkable, right? In that, like, you have a parallel society to ours. Ours is really hierarchical. You have somebody on the top, and then, you know, we have computers to organize that. We have taxes, and we all kind of in a hierarchical system where we do our things. And to a certain degree, we are told what we should be, right? Bees don't do that, right? There is no real hierarchy. We might kind of say there's a queen, but the queen is actually just a reproductive organ in a superorganism. She has very little power in there. If she is not doing what the workers want, they kill her and they replace her, right?
Seems normal.
Yeah. Can we do that?
Yeah. That's an option, right? That's an option.
Just spreading some ideas.
Biomimicry is okay, right? That's all I'm doing.
It's but science.
That means we are dealing with a neural network that keeps some information in there, that processes information, that responds to stimuli. But there is no hierarchical system. There's not the super bee sitting in there and saying, oh, who today looks really bright. Why not going out and have some pollination, right? That's not how it happens. It is information that comes in that is stored in these bees, also on the comb, So the comb is like a little library, and when they crawl over the comb where the larvae are, they with their feet they basically read what's going on or what the information is, what is stored in there. And somehow they manage that these 80,000 bees that are in there all know what to do at every time. And as I said, you can disturb that system really heavily. Imagine you basically split Los Angeles into two bits, right? Random. And say, okay, you have to organize yourself now. Right, you need to build highways, and you need, oh, you don't have any schools in that area. Yeah. Get it sorted. It would be chaos.
I mean, it's chaos with Los Angeles as one city.
I might not live long enough here to actually get the food, but on the way here, I get you. Okay.
Yeah.
But I just say, like, a beehive can readjust itself in a matter of 2 to 3 days, and it's in balance again.
Yeah, that was something I was going to ask about, because at the beginning of the film, he says that they like graduate school in like a couple of days, and then something happens like really, really quickly. Is that how it works? Do they, like you just said, they can just restructure a hive within a couple of days? So
they do that, yeah. And I don't know how much that has been looked at in honeybees, which is the main kind of species that is covered in the movie. But if you look at bumblebees, which is the other species that I worked with, they have now found that you have teacher bees. So you have bees, and other bees watch them. So they gave them in the lab to figure that out. They gave them little homework. So one bee had to pick up a little kind of ball and throw that into a hole, and then the bee got a reward, sugar water. Mm-hmm. You get almost everything out of a bee if you give it sugar water. Right? So that bee learns to do the job, but that bee can then teach other bees, other bumblebees, how to do it. I mean, that's quite remarkable.
So would you say that passes the threshold? And I know that this word is not well defined, but would you say that passes the threshold for something like culture? Like, do you think in bees there is something like generational learning in a structured way?
That's the big question, right? Yeah. And I don't know whether...
I don't know. I'm asking very open-ended. I feel like I offended Boris earlier. I'm really not trying to, but...
No, not
he seems
really.
Furious.
Right. Yeah.
He's been shaking his fist for an hour.
Been two middle fingers up for like a long time.
I didn't want to call attention to it, but it seemed rude. I don't know.
Do you think that qualifies as like cultural transmission or...
There are discussions about that.
Yeah.
And that is also a discussion, where does culture really start? What are the kind of foundations of a culture?
It all depends on how you define
but
it and stuff.
You
obviously.
Actually reached it by yourself. Just 10 minutes ago, you told me they're just robots.
Yeah.
Now you ask me, do they have culture? So that's quite a jump on
your end. I also think humans are mostly robotic, and we clearly have culture. I think consciousness is an illusion overall. So, you know, my biases are what they are. I don't think being a robot precludes you from having a culture. Yeah.
Where it'll just be robot culture, isn't
it? I think robots have a certain amount of flexibility built in, but, you know.
Yeah.
But I also would define a thermostat as a robot. So, you know, it's like it's all the philosophy of language of it all. Falls apart very quickly.
I mean, it sounds like they do. They have personalities. They're in different moods. They can like read each other through just not even talking, just these like, and it seems like they read what we're saying. Like if I opened up one of these panels, they could probably read my fear or something through, I don't know what, energy pheromones or something, and understand it, like communicate with me in a sort of way.
We tried a couple of experiments in that area to see like can we see differences, and it's not so easy to read their minds. I think we are at the moment better to try to understand them than to see like what do they think about me when I'm coming along there. But I think there are ideas around. They're not around for that long to say, okay, if we give like the colony as a whole a personality, you know, where does culture... There are discussions about that come up at the moment. How to kind of deal with these societies. It's not just honeybees, right? It's the bees in general, but we also have the ants. They even have kind of driven these societies even to larger kind of extremes.
Well, to piggyback on the culture humanistic side of it, in the movie, obviously they, as Alex pointed out earlier, they sue the human race for taking all their honey.
It's the apex of any culture is, can you file a lawsuit and have it be taken seriously regardless of how frivolous it is? So clearly, in that regard, the bees have culture according to the film.
But there are two frustrating outcomes of that. The first one is that he wins the lawsuit.
He does win the lawsuit.
Yeah. Great speech at the end.
But then, like, so the honey is given back.
Right.
And he gets the honey back, but his colony actually didn't ever provide any honey to the shopping mall.
So they still need to make their own honey, and then they like...
Right.
He's coming from a what we call non-managed hive, right? He's hanging in the tree there. They have a good life.
Yeah, they skipped over that one.
No beekeeper comes there and steals honey. Then he sues human mankind, and then he gets the honey. That's not really just.
That's like stealing.
I would argue that part of the movie is very accurate to the American legal system.
Oh yeah, that's true.
The lawyers get it.
Judicially speaking, that checks out.
So I mean, I guess they did do their homework somewhere, you know.
And is it rude to take their honey? Do they make enough of it? They don't need it. The environment doesn't need it.
That's the other thing that disturbs me, because like, so they have to give the honey back, and then the conclusion from that is that the ecosystem breaks down.
Right.
Why would the ecosystem break down if you give them back the honey? They would still continue. Right? They just produce more bees and they produce more.
Well, they started tanning.
Like, you know, it's not like the only idea that makes it work is like, well, they got so much honey back. None of these bees never really need to make honey ever again. But that's dumb.
It's not their honey anyway. They got the honey from someone else.
Right. So now instead of the humans exploiting these hives, you're doing it.
And they reference a couple of times that the bees are around for 26 million years, which is actually unfortunately wrong. Like the early bees are 110 million years old. So they saw the dinosaurs coming and going.
They mentioned that fact in the movie?
Twice.
They got the time period wrong?
Yeah, they got the time period wrong. There's some entitlement from the human race, and they're like, we have to take the honey to keep the environment intact. Or did I? That's what I was reading in.
Right. Right?
So
yes.
We have to take it because otherwise the bees get lazy and then they don't pollinate, and then the entire ecosystem breaks
lazy.
Down.
Yes.
So there's some human entitlement that we have, or we have an obligation to do that, which probably answers your question, right? It's like, do we have to take it? No, we don't have to take it, but it's like, if we keep the bees and we provide them with housing and we look after them, we can take that honey off.
Okay.
And we take that honey off as well.
So we're not taking their like emergency supplies. We're not harming the bees by taking their honey.
No, because like the way the beekeeper is depicted in that movie is completely wrong.
He's the bad guy.
You're evil. And also,
immediately evil.
Is the bee smoker tobacco smoke? That can't be right,
no.
right?
No. Bees never pass out if you smoke them. Never, ever.
They showed, I think, multiple times. Yes. Yeah, a bunch of bees passing out.
So there are like things which just don't make sense.
It felt like they heard about bees. Someone like, you know, was like flying from like LA to New York and had like a Westways magazine, and there was like a blurb about bees, and they're like, I got everything I need.
I got it. While watching a movie.
We can write the movie now.
If you work with beekeepers, and I did that quite a lot, both with commercial ones, so these are, you know, the big ones and they have a lot of colonies, but
and out in Australia where you don't wear any armor apparently.
Yeah. But it's like the larger part of people that keep bees are the hobbyist beekeepers. Mm-hmm. And they love their bees. They would never do anything that harms them.
What does the smoker do then?
The smoker is... there are different kind of theories around what it does. So first of all, you're not kind of smoking the bees to death. You give them a little puff, right? And one idea is that you cover yourself in something neutral, right? So they can't really smell you. So it's like it keeps them down, right? Mm-hmm. Or it covers their own pheromones that they spread around. The other theory that is out there is that like bees are used to wildfires. So if they smell the smoke, they actually go in and they start to kind of rescue the honey and get ready for swarming. Whoa. So it's the...
So wait, it's just smoke though? It's not like... I assumed it was some sort of... pesticide, pheromone, something to calm them or like, not, yeah.
No, it's
I mean, I thought
product.
They got knocked out also, though, so what do I know? Bee movie is my extent here.
No, what we use is burlap. We will never use or burn. Some people use newspaper. Others use like needles that they collect from pine trees, things like that. It's almost religious, like that different beekeepers would use different things, but you never add anything. You would never add any pesticide, anything like that.
Because everyone's got their own like woodland recipe of like, six oak leaves and two acorns, and I roast them slowly. Yeah. You know?
But it has to be dry, and people use, some beekeepers even refuse to use the smoker because they say like, I want to have that direct interaction with the bees. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds the best. In theory, I don't know.
I think if I smoke the bees, I don't think it really... I see any indications that the bees would be annoyed by that. I mean, if I really smoke them hard, for example, I want to put the lid back on, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to squeeze a bee.
Sure.
So I basically smoke the top and the bees then go into the hive in between the frames, and then I can put the lid on.
Yeah.
And in between, I only smoke bees if I feel they become a bit agitated.
Yeah.
So I give them a little puff, but it has nothing to do with how it is depicted in the bee movie. And you have to see that from a beekeeper's perspective, the value of his company is not the boxes, it's not even the honey. The value of his company is the number of live healthy bees. Because if he loses that, he loses everything.
Yeah. Wow.
So the last thing that the beekeeper wants is to harm his or her bees in any way.
Crazy.
And that's what happens on the ground. And the beekeeper in the movie is depicted as this greedy person who basically...
The worst. Everyone knows you want to make a ton of money, you get into the honey business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're like maniacally laughing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Like, visit some of the hobbyist kind of... evenings when they come together and look at how these people care about bees, how they introduce others to bees. A beekeeper is somebody who deeply cares about that animal. It's also like if you go to the cat friends or the dog friends, they're not kind of meeting to mistreat their dogs, right? They love their dogs and they look after them and they want to keep them healthy and happy.
Okay, I have two last questions. We're running low on time, although I really think if there's another bee movie, we should gather again because I have so...
God help us all if they make a sequel to the bee movie.
Well, not a sequel, but...
In the very beginning, I said there were two revenges I took when I saw the bee movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whoa, love
this. The first one was I would mention it in my lectures and basically point out all the things that are wrong.
Yeah,
the second one is that the Empire needs to strike back. Ooh. And... we have somebody in our family who is a movie maker.
I love this. Yes.
Oh, great.
And he did a movie which came out 2012. It was called More Than Honey.
Modern Honey.
More Than Honey.
More Than Honey.
More Than Honey.
More Than Honey. And that we did the scientific kind of advisory for that. That's a movie that actually is a direct response to the bee movie. But I think that movie got it right. So the biology of the movie is in there. Okay. Also the way...
So the biology of the movie is right. The bees all have four legs.
Yeah.
They all have haircuts and sweaters. Like everything is correct.
It's accurate.
Yeah.
Well, watch the movie, right?
Yeah. Pollen jocks are all big, strong males.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so one was we can't make honey. Or are we able to synthesize this as humans, or do we have to rely on the bees? Like, if we do lose the bees, is honey over with?
Honey's over. We can't do it. It's a complicated process. So they get the nectar, and they have what we call a social stomach. So you can
social stomach.
A social stomach. Okay. So you can eat for yourself or you can eat for the colony.
Oh, right? Yeah, I need one of those.
So what that means is they basically take the nectar into the social stomach, and when they come home, they regenerate that stuff and transfer it to the next bee. But they already they remove water and they also add some bacteria or some kind of microorganisms that transform the nectar into honey. Right? So the bad news here is that if you eat honey again, it's basically bee vomit, okay? And it has been vomited a couple of times.
Yeah.
But once they put it into the comb, there is a process. You cannot just harvest the honey immediately. You actually have to wait until that fermentation and these processes have taken place.
Wow.
And during that time, what the bee is doing is it extremely increases the sugar content in the honey. And that's why honey is the longest lasting human food product on the globe.
I read a book once about honey, and it was basically making the point that until like a couple hundred years ago, like maybe like the 1600s, when we figured out how to refine cane sugar, honey was literally the sweetest thing any human had ever tasted.
Yes.
Wow.
Like it was the most concentrated sugar for thousands of years on the planet.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's delicious and
it's great.
And
great.
Any high culture, human high culture, always had a link to bees. The Chinese kept bees, the Babylonians kept bees, the Egyptians kept bees. They worshipped these bees. It was always like, in these cultures, it was always a messenger of some deity from the other world. You can go to Egypt and they excavated some of the pharaoh tombs and they found honey in there because the honey was the tear of the highest god, Ra. So it was a direct link to the higher gods. But this 3,000, 4,000, 5,000-year-old honey, you can still consume. It's still edible.
Is it good?
I don't think they just kind of distribute that.
Hard to get. So
yeah, yeah, you can't go get it at Whole Foods or something.
I was unfortunately so far not the chosen one to try that out, yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But we know that like in some labs that we have today, that there is like a honey that we still have and it's decades to hundreds of years old and it's still intact, right? It's not going to ferment.
The thing you're saying about all cultures have like, you know, a beekeeping thing. I took a bunch of philosophy of language and linguistics courses in college because that's rad.
Yeah.
My linguistics professor told us once about a theory where a bunch of different linguists were trying to figure out where human language originated. And the way they were doing that was by looking at commonalities across unrelated human languages, you know, like, so going back to like the root languages and like, you know, the varying language families and trying to find out like, what are the words that are similar across all these things? And it was all words related to beekeeping.
Really?
Wow. Yes. And to the point where they used that to draw a map of where these languages originated and thought that the birth of language due to this beekeeping clue was somewhere in the Georgian mountains in Russia.
Yeah,
like,
my God.
You know, which, you know, so the idea that there was some ancient like Neanderthal, like, you know, group of beekeepers who finally just had to be like, this stuff is great. We got to give it a name, you know, like that's what birthed modern language is like incredible, you know, like what a wonderful thing for bees to contribute.
Yeah. Well, the bee is one of the oldest domesticated animals that we have, probably the second one after the dog. And we know that because of depictions, which are 10 to 15,000 years old. So as soon as we invented the art of graffiti in the caves, immediately you see depiction of people climbing up the rocks and into trees and getting the bees down.
That's very cool.
And the bee originates from Asia, right? So we can go into these areas. We can look at like tribes that are still around, how they do that. And so the first thing is you have a little bird and the bird searches for the beehive and then the people climb up there sometimes. I don't know that in feet, but it's in meters, like 30, 50, 60 meters up a cliff or in a tree, and they get the beehive down. But then you destroy the hive. So the second kind of step, and we can still see that, is you're actually going up there, and instead of destroying the entire hive, you just take the outside combs, which contain the honey, but you leave the rest of the colony up there, and you remember where that is. And then you can come back, right? So you start to care about the animal, you manage that animal. It's the first form of domestication.
Wow.
And if you look at the very old kind of fragments that we find, I think in Africa, but also around the Mediterranean, old pottery or so, we still find almost with the first kind of appearance of these pottery fragments, you can find residuals of honey wax in there because honey wax has a fingerprint identity, right? So this relationship between us and the bees is very old, and the domestication of the bee in the end is very, very old. And if you go to the Egyptians, which is like 3,000 to 8,000 years ago, they had a fully blown excellent running beekeeping industry. They transported bees on the River Nile. They had the hive set up. They had all set up already.
I mean, making a good case for bees being potentially the coolest animal of all time. It sounds, I'm really, I did not know so much of this.
The coolest robot of all time.
Sorry.
let's get our terminology straight here.
Some Philistines on the way. But I got you already, you're already halfway there.
Yeah. So here's my last thing, and I'm hesitant to even bring it up because of how embarrassing it is for me. But ever since I was little, I've been afraid of bees, afraid of wasps, hornets, etc. This is supposedly a fairly common thing. People are, they don't like the sound, they run when they see them, they freak out. People freaked out in the movie, so that was something accurate that they knew.
Yes.
Am I just being incredibly silly? Is there nothing to fear? I've never been stung. Is a sting not that bad? When I see a bee near me and I'm walking, should I just say hi, keep walking, you know? Or should I keep my distance and, I don't know, dodge away?
According to the movie, if you say hi to the bee, it might respond, right?
It might respond,
that's true.
So, the mess that you create with that could be unbelievable. So maybe
might
don't
have to
do
fly
that.
A plane.
I don't know. It's like, we bring a lot of students into the bee yard, and the majority of the students that I teach are actually not biologists. It's a course, bees and beekeeping, and we have 30 students, and I would say 25 plus of them are economy people, social sciences, theater, whatever, right?
Okay.
And you can see that in the beginning, that fear, that kind of respect about the animal, right? I think that's not bad.
Okay.
Right? It's like if you see a rattlesnake, you don't go there and pet it either.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's...
Or maybe you don't, but I'm a man.
Yeah, Alex Berg does.
I fear no snake bite, nor bee sting, nor dog bite.
Goes into the woods punching.
I go, yeah, you see a rattlesnake, I go, if I kick his butt, he kicks mine. And then we sit down, have a whiskey, and talk it out.
Yeah. You know Steve Irvine, right? He can bat.
Yeah, badly. I don't mess with no stingray.
I don't keep my distance.
Yeah, yeah.
But what happens if you get introduced to the animal and you get, you know, I put you in a bee suit, I bring you into the bee yard, and you're doing that for an hour or so, you start to realize by yourself, and that's what I see with the students, that you start to lose that fear because you realize that the bee is actually predictable. It's not out there to kill you. It's not out there to sting you. Most times when I get stung is because I do stupid things, you know. So the bee gets angry. Right? If it's cold or...
But I do stupid things all the time.
Yeah, it's maybe human, right? It's like...
Damn it.
But we learn, right? That's where we are clever than other things. It's like I hope that we learn through our errors and then the next time we improve it. But you learn to weed the animals. You learn how to, you know, when there is danger or not. You have to learn how to interact with that animal. For example, you have to stop kind of, you know, making fast movements and scream and yell around and run around.
Right.
You have to, the beast... force you to calm down.
Okay.
And I actually really like that because like our life is so hectic. If you go to the bees and you do bee research, you can't do it in a hectic.
Cool.
The bees dominate you and the bees dictate you how you work together with them.
Right?
And I think if you go through that experience, I'm almost sure that you would lose that fear.
So you're saying I should come by... What
you should.
It? University of California.
We
you guys have a bunch of bees out
if
there.
You want to do that, yeah.
And look, I don't want to do it, but I'll do it.
You're completely protected. We're doing that now for 10 years with students. Here we are running now the third course.
Mm-hmm.
No student was ever bee stung. Because
wow.
I give them like an introduction lecture. This is how you behave. You're fully geared up. Like
sure.
You have a bee suit. You have gloves. You know. So in the beginning, you're like a little knight, and you can go in there and you can experience for yourself. But there's no danger.
I like the image of being a little knight. That sounds fun.
Look a little bit like a knight. I think it makes great selfies. But
Brett, bring a camera.
Yeah,
I'm going in like a little knight with all these bees, man. That sounds fun.
But that allows you to experience that animal for what it really is, right?
Yeah.
And we never had a student to this point dropping out, although they all said, like, I've never seen a bee from close by, and we were kind of worried about this all.
Yeah.
So
have you been stung, Alex? Do you have experience?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, I literally, I don't know if you can see, but there's like a small bump.
Oh, yeah.
Over my left eye, because when I was 6 or 7, mm-hmm. I was watering some plants in my front yard for my mom. And the house I grew up in had these wooden columns, which now I know are hollow and full of bees.
Huh?
This was the day I found out.
Right.
And I just, there was like a little like hole at the bottom of the column. Bees weren't swarming out of it or anything. I was just like, oh, cool, a hole. I'll put water in it. And sprayed water in it and got totally swarmed and stung over the eye. I had to have an eye patch on for a few days.
Damn.
I got stung another time. I was in high school. We were going canoeing. We hadn't been out on this like lake because it had been winter and it was like spring. We're like, yeah, we'll go out on the canoe. I was very high at the time, so it's possible this was my fault. And the canoe, there had been a hole in the outer part of the hull, like the fiberglass shell. And now I know the canoe was hollow and full of bees. And when we put the canoe in the water, the bees flew out and stung me like right in the temple.
Whoa, again, next to the eye.
Yeah, like I've been stung so many times. I stepped on a bee once. I used to go everywhere barefoot. And
wait, you used to go everywhere barefoot?
Yeah, I went to a college that was clothing optional, so I just didn't wear shoes ever.
What? Does that mean naked people went there?
Sometimes.
Wow, what
sometimes.
College is this?
It's Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Sure.
Very, very progressive.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like I've stepped on bees, I've picked up dead bees and been stung by dead bees.
That one seems like your fault.
Yeah, yeah,
picking up a dead bee.
Well, my dog used to eat dead. We had like a bee problem for a while when I was a kid. Wow. And my dog would eat the dead bees and get stung on the tongue. And I saw him going for a dead bee. And I was like, no, sir, I'll take this hit, and got stung. You know, like,
wow.
So I've been stung by bees, not nearly as many as Boris, I'm sure, but a lot. And it's like a pain in the ass. Oh, my God. I got stung. I forgot about this until just now. I got stung by bees one time. I was on a golf cart. This is a long, the setup, the reason why this is not.
It was that hollow and full of bees.
Honestly, I was in a golf cart. My brother hit the pedal and drove into a railroad tie that was like holding up this part of my grandfather's yard. The railroad tie came loose. Turns out the yard was hollow and full of bees. And so not only was I thrown from the golf cart and landed face first on a gravel driveway, I then was like standing up and dealing with that, like plucking gravel out of my face.
Yikes.
Stung by a ton of bees. Like, they all swarmed my leg. I was just like,
Could it kind of be helpful for you to know that this could actually be good for you? Because there is like in Asia, there's AP therapy, where they use bee stings for medical treatments.
How does that help? Yes.
So some of it is Asian medicine, so you believe it or not, right? Uh-huh. But we actually picked some of these up. So I had one PhD student. I still have one PhD student in Australia. There was this rumor around that bee poison is really kind of killing cancer cells. Huh. And she has done research over the last 3 years, and we actually found some papers on that, so peer-reviewed papers. And what she found is actually amazing. The bee venom is the super killer of breast cancer in women.
Really?
Yeah. So there are even ideas of how that works, because the cancer cell has a very different structure. The surface has a very different structure compared to a healthy cell. And the bee poison is much more effective in drilling holes into that membrane and kill that cell.
Oh my God.
And
when did these reports come out?
I don't think they are out, but there are some papers out that report that anti-cancer. They tried it with different cancers. So we know, and that's nothing new, that bee venom has very effective anti-cancer properties. We also know that for hundreds of maybe thousands of years, bee venom and bee products have always been used for medical treatments in humans. The Egyptians used that.
And purposefully sting themselves.
Yes. One of the things is, and I didn't do that, but my beekeeper did it, that you know you have these acupuncture points?
Yeah.
And they put the bee in there. So you get stung.
So when they stung your temple, you didn't know this, but could have been saving your life.
I was getting acupuncture at the time.
Yeah, acupuncture. Much better name for the movie, by the way.
There is a higher risk to get stung in the temples because bees are, they look for contrast. They don't like dark colors. So you have a white face and then you have like your eyebrows and there's a contrast. So they're going straight for that, right?
Oh.
That's why the bee suit is white.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically neutral, right? You don't provide them with too much contrast.
Not that you need the bee suit at all. Apparently.
I think here in Southern California, where you kind of have bees with character,
you probably
put on a bee suit. Yes.
All right. Okay, good to know.
Or if you're like planning on going canoeing, take a bee suit with you.
Go-kart,
take a bee suit. Standing in the yard, take a bee suit. You know, like, there's a couple opportunities.
We can make them fashionable.
Take a bee suit. Yeah. You know.
I think if you work with bees, you would start to realize, you see the early signs before they start to attack you. Right? Mm-hmm. There's a smell in the air, which is lemon banana-like. That's the hormone when they recruit the others, right?
Oh.
And the other thing is, like, when you get stung, you're actually marked. That's why the stinger stays inside and the bee dies. And he really dies. Like, there is no emergency room or anything like that. Yeah, the bee dies.
I saw in a film somewhere, I don't know what film, it could have been anything, it was probably a David Attenborough documentary, that when a bee dies, they get a pink plastic cocktail sword put on their rear end.
Yeah.
But that's true, right? You're saying that's true?
Yeah, and that they live.
They live. They go to a human hospital where the surgery happens.
Yeah, honey's IV'd to them.
Yes. Can't be bad. Yes.
So they die every time.
They die.
For sure.
Yeah.
That stinks.
Well, it's a self-sacrifice, but it's for the good of the colony, right? So they're actually protecting their own colony. But what they do, and the reason why the stinger is in there, there's a gland attached to the stinger that stays inside you. And that releases a pheromone. So once you're stung once, you are marked as the enemy. And the others smell that.
That's why you got stung multiple times.
Yes. Yeah. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, dude. I got so ganged up on.
Once you get stung, you move away and you give them their room, right?
Yeah, you're a bee killer for life.
Yes.
And you got to wear that now.
That's why when we get stung, we normally kind of, we remove the stinger as soon as possible to get the pheromone off. And then we smoke that to cover cover whatever you are covered in that recruitment pheromone. And yeah. The only reason between the difference between the Africanized bees and the managed bees is actually the threshold, right? So when do they start to really go after you?
Right.
And the managed bees, we basically bred them so they are whatever, right? Yeah, that's
more
fine.
Chill.
One sting is still fine, five, okay. The Africanized immediately go, right?
Mm.
But if a bear's coming along, you know, the managed ones is, they're goners, right?
Okay, guys, we're going over a little bit, which I'm sure everyone appreciates. I certainly appreciate it. I have 3 pages of questions here to ask you, so I will have to beg both of you to come back at some point. Thank you so much for being here.
Next
it was a
time
ton
we'll
of fun.
Watch More Than Honey instead, right?
Yes, honestly, we should probably and talk about it. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to tell people about Boris? Something? Can they? Where do they take your classes? Should they come visit this? I don't know what you call it. Bee farm.
Well, we run an APRI, which is a research and teaching APRI at UCR, and we do that for the students that are at UCR.
That's the cyber. Is that what that is? Or is that something
is cyber,
else?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Great.
So that's in the entire structure.
So get into cyber, donate your time, money.
If this can kind of get some people excited and interested to look into this really exciting life of bees, which is very different from the bee movie. I think it's even more exciting with all the stories that we touched
by
now.
Yeah, it sounds way more exciting.
It's so exciting. It's like, then I think I've reached what I want. It's like, I think like we lose all the bees. We all know that. That's now common knowledge. We have to redefine the way we interact with that animal. I think we have to redefine the relationship that we have with that animal. And in the early days, every farmer, even people kind of kept a few bees behind the house. And if I ask my students, my uncle, yes, my grandfather had that. And I think to a certain degree, if you could go a bit back there and have that relation, have that animal around us, even in the cities, that would be really helpful.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
Alex Berg.
I guess if you're in Los Angeles, come check out Convoy at 11 p.m. At UCB Franklin. If you're not in Los Angeles, you can find me on Twitter, where mostly I share pictures of my daughter, my dog, and my accomplishments in video games. Twitter.com/actuallyberg. I don't know. I would just say if I have like a parting thing, like go read stuff. Like don't. Go read like books and like articles, like, you know, you can work yourself up to a point where you can go on archive before things are published and you can understand it, because there's a lot of cool science out there. And I think people are a little closed off to it. And I'd like to see that turn around.
Beautiful. I will second both of those things.
Yeah,
you read a honey book and a bee book just for this. Clearly, this was your goal, to read both of those books to be on this program the entire time.
This
obviously.
I'm really hoping I get a lot of job offers off of this. So
in bee. Communication.
Put my best foot forward. Yeah. I'm trying to get a job at a hive out west. So.
And I have to second Convoy as well.
I've been multiple times.
And it is one of the most unbelievable shows you can check out in Los Angeles Thursday nights at UCB Franklin.
Yeah, we're still there.
Thank you guys so much. See you next time where we'll be talking about More Than Honey. Is that correct?
Okay.
Did
Sounds
I get
like
that?
It, yeah.
Okay, great.
Great. Thank you.
Bye. Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our social media producers are EJ Gullett and Kate Baker. Coordinator is Brett Kushner. Follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. That's at Bad Science Show. We always post pictures of our guests, and sometimes we make some fun videos and such. Feel free to email us, badscience@seeker.com, for movie recommendations or any other thoughts on the episode. And if you would please leave an iTunes review, that would be great. I'll see you next week. Bye.